And today I'm going to talk about the teachings of Nagarjuna. So I would say this talk is about Nagarjuna, except it's really about the teachings of Nagarjuna. And that's because not much is known about the person called Nagarjuna. He's said to have been born into a Brahmin family around 150 or 250 in the Common Era, been a Buddhist monk, and lived somewhere in India. according to Wikipedia, the earliest surviving accounts of his life were written in Chinese and Tibetan, centuries after his death, and are historically unverifiable. Just so you know, he's listed as one of the ancestors of the Chan lineage. So in Zen, the lineage was traced back to Buddha. Scholars believe this is not an accurate lineage, but in any case, he's on it. He's number 14 after Buddha. Now, a few of you might be familiar with his teachings and have some ideas about how to pronounce his name, so I thought I would get that out of the way. I say Nagarjuna. Another common pronunciation is Nagarjuna, kind of flows, you know. For help, I consulted the internet and heard both renderings. AI likes my way, but we know AI can be wrong, so we don't know. I don't know how he said it, but I just wanted to say something about that. So moving on. He is noted to be the founder of the Madhyamaka or Middle Path school of Mahayana Buddhism and a proponent generally of the Mahayana branch of Buddhism, which includes the Bodhisattva ideal and is distinct and, I would say, sort of more expansive than the Theravada school. Nagarjuna did a lot of writing. He wrote for all kinds of people, all audiences, for lay people, for rulers. One text I consulted described him as, quote, undoubtedly the most important, influential, and widely studied Mahayana Buddhist philosopher. I've seen references to him being called Second Buddha. And I just want to note here that he lived about 700 years after Shakyamuni Buddha's time. I really didn't know much about Nagarjuna and his teachings before this talk came my way. When you look for material associated with him, you very quickly find direction to what's called the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, abbreviated as the MMK. And the translation of Mula Madhyamaka Karika is the Fundamental Verses on the Middle Way. So this work has been described as Nagarjuna's largest and best known text. It consists of 450 verses, four-line verses, divided into 27 chapters. So in a copy I have, the verses take up about 80 paperback pages. So it's not really voluminous, but there's some substance to it. It's the teachings of this text that I'll be primarily talking about today. And it's rather technical material. I call it technical, for lack of a better term. And I've done my best to understand it myself and present it in a way that's accessible. But I've also intentionally made a point of presenting it, some of the translated text, and I've not shied away from what might be conceptually challenging. And I did that because I really wanted to have us have a taste, you know, and a flavor of what he wrote and conveyed. So, the Fundamental Verses on the Middle Way, the MMK. What does this treatise tell us? Boiled down to a point, it's that all things are empty. That is, devoid of permanent essence or intrinsic nature. All things are without persisting thingness. And this assertion underpins much of the teachings of Buddhism. So I'll talk more about empty and emptiness a little later. But that's what it comes down to. That's what he's talking about in this work. So how does he present this, his teaching. His methodology for conveying the message is sometimes called proof by contradiction. And philosophers have a name for this. In Latin, it's reductio ad absurdum. The reductio ad absurdum. This is a form of argument that tries to prove a claim by showing that a contrary proposition would lead to an absurd result. So it's something like this. If you say this, then that has to be true. But since that is obviously not true, this cannot be true. Sometimes this is called indirect proof. So here are a couple of examples of reductio ad absurdum found on the web. The first one is the flat earth theory. If the earth were flat, then people walking to the edge would fall off. People do not fall off the edge. Therefore, the earth cannot be flat. And the second one is the barber paradox. So here's the proposition. There is a town which has a barber who shaves all those and only those who do not shave themselves. So sounds pretty reasonable, I think. But if the barber is someone who does not shave himself, then he must by definition shave himself. But if he shaves himself, he cannot by definition be someone who does not shave himself. So, because the original proposition that such a person exists leads to this absurd conclusion, or conclusions rather, the proposition cannot be true. So let's listen to some of the language from the MMK. I'm using a translation of this work by Thich Nhat Hanh. And I'll tell you that I scoured around for books about Nagarjuna. And the first couple that I got and referred to were books on the philosophy of Buddhism, written by philosophers. And they weren't unhelpful. But then I came upon Thich Nhat Hanh's work on Nagarjuna, which is called Cracking the Walnut. And if you're interested in this stuff, then I can recommend that book because he translates it in a certain way, and then he's got a lot of commentary. So I depended heavily on that. So the MMK. This is the first stanza in the first chapter. There's a little introduction, but when we get into the work itself, the first stanza is in the first chapter, and the chapter is entitled Examination of Conditions. So throughout the work, he's examining things. So this chapter is addressing, among other things, the existence or non-existence of phenomena. So here's the first stanza. Phenomena are not born of themselves, nor from others, nor both from themselves and others, nor without a cause. Therefore, we know they are unborn. So I'll unpack that a little bit. So spending some time with this, it seemed to come through pretty clearly. I will say something about my delving into this. When I first, I was nervous because I knew that this might be tough. I thought it would. And so then I started reading it and I thought, oh, I get that. And then I started writing about it and I realized, I don't really get this thing. It's pretty hard. Anyway, at first, these first lines seem clear enough. You know, nothing comes into existence from itself, or from something else, or from both, or from nothing. So that's the assertion. Now the argument for this assertion, and this is where it gets abstruse. This chapter, this first chapter, has 14 verses, and here is number 6. In this verse, we can hear the use of reductio ad absurdum, this proof by contradiction. Now, this verse uses the terms conditions and effect. And I want to say ahead of time that when these terms are used, it's referring to permanent, immutable phenomena, things with unchanging self-nature. So conditions as something real and permanent, and an effect that is real and immutable. So here it is. To say that the effect, prior to arising, exists or not within the conditions has no meaning. If it does not exist, then what does the condition condition? And if it does exist, then why do we need a condition? So here's an interpretation of this stanza by me. To say that something permanent and immutable can arise from conditions, or from no conditions at all, doesn't make sense. If something with unchanging essence or intrinsic nature does not exist, it would not make sense to say that some condition or circumstance could bring it into existence. And if there is something that exists that has intrinsic unchanging nature, no condition would be necessary to bring it about. So let's try an example. And the example is of fire and what might be considered the conditions for fire. So this I borrowed directly from Thich Nhat Hanh. A box of matches and the air around it appear to contain the conditions for fire, but not the essence of fire. For example, the matches by themselves do not exhibit the fire aspects of heat or light. So fire essence is not present in the matches. If the essence of fire did exist in matches, why would we need matches as a condition for fire? If the essence of fire is not present in the matches, how can we say that matches by themselves are a condition for fire? Now, these arguments sometimes sound like semantic gymnastics, and pretty obvious ones too, or rather weak arguments. But they're more than that. They point to fundamental questions of existence and non-existence, and touch on the concepts of cause and effect. In short, they have to do with the nature of reality. So I thought this would be a good time to note the circumstances in which Nagarjuna was writing and teaching. As I said earlier, he lived about 700 years after Buddha's time. And after the Buddha's death, we know that there were councils. There was the first council where they really tried to, where his followers really tried to nail down and codify the Buddhist teachings. But as the years went by, the Buddhist lineage split into multiple schools. And among these were some that held that there were things that possessed material essence. That is, things that were not empty. So Nagarjuna's work is not simply an expression of his own understanding, but rather it's his response to what he saw as centuries-long distortions of the Buddhist teaching. And it's his work is his effort to reestablish the correct teachings of Buddha. So I'm speculating slightly here, but I think this is likely why he goes into detail about conditions and effects and other terms and concepts that are used in this work. It's because those things were being debated at that time and in those terms. A minute ago, I said that this first chapter addresses cause and effect. So I'm going to talk about cause and effect for a second. For there to be a cause, we have to be able to identify something as a cause. And for there to be an effect, we would have to be able to identify something as an effect. So cause comes and then effect in time. According to Thich Nhat Hanh, Shakyamuni Buddha seemed to teach cause and effect. That is, Buddha taught, this is because that is, and this ceases because that ceases. Thich Nhat Hanh said that to interpret this teaching as cause and effect is incorrect, and that instead the correct interpretation is what he calls conditioned co-arising. Sometimes this is called, or has been called, dependent origination. He calls it conditioned co-arising. No thing exists as a separate entity, like a cause, or as a distinct and separate effect. But instead, each thing manifests in relationship to everything else. So Thich Nhat Hanh uses this word, manifests. In this way, the fire depends on the match. But to be identified as a match, the match also depends on fire. The egg depends on the hen, and the hen depends on the egg. Fire depends on oxygen, and oxygen depends on everything that brings about oxygen. Nothing appears from itself, just like in this first stanza of the first chapter. Nothing appears from itself, or from something else, or from nothing, but rather all things manifest with all. In Buddhism, this is more than just philosophical reasoning. Rather, it is truth, derived from direct insight, and described with this kind of language. So dependent origination sounds like cause and effect, but cause and effect are one. So how does emptiness fit in with this? Emptiness is a term we hear a lot in Buddhism. What is emptiness? Earlier I said that emptiness means without essence or intrinsic nature. That is, anything we can describe or name or experience is, in fact, empty. Empty of what? Empty of permanent, unchanging essence. Or as we sometimes say, empty of self-nature. There is no process of reduction that can reveal a permanently existing, unchanging thing or essence. We can't reduce things down to some fundamental thing which exists in a permanent way. So what we call a match manifests provisionally, but it has no persisting immutable essence that is separate from everything else. So here's a key point. You might know this already, or even if you've never heard anything about this stuff, you might have already come to it. So to say things are empty is not to say that things don't appear as form. Emptiness does not mean nothingness. It does not mean a vacuum. Phenomena are real. So we say they are constantly changing, but that's not quite right. Rather, they are change. They are flux. Our true nature is change. I remember Zen Master Jibong saying this. He said it right here. Everything is flux and flow, he said. Nothing is static or immutable. Emptiness is the name we give to the unfolding manifestation of phenomena, the conditioned co-arising of what we ordinarily identify as things. In Buddhism, the truth of emptiness is the middle way between the extreme concepts of existence and non-existence. So as I said, there's 27 chapters in this MMK, and I'm only touching on two of them. So the first chapter, examination of conditions, and now chapter 24, examination of the Four Noble Truths. Many of the verses in the MMK make use of a device an idea of an opponent, the voice of someone who holds an opposing view to that of Nagarjuna. So sometimes the opponent speaks, and then Nagarjuna responds. This device is used in the chapter on the Four Noble Truths. This chapter has 18 verses, and the first 6 verses are the assertions of the opposing view. The first verse goes like this. If everything is empty, unborn and undying, the teachings of the Four Noble Truths cannot exist. This is the opponent speaking to Nagarjuna. The opponent is telling Nagarjuna that if what he says about emptiness is true, then the teachings of the Buddha cannot be true. If the Four Noble Truths aren't true, then people can't enter the stream of awakening. The Holy Sangha cannot form, the Three Jewels cannot come into being, and ultimately people will abandon morality and proper conduct. So, if emptiness is true, it would lead to disaster. The remaining 12 verses in this chapter are Nagarjuna's response to the opponent's assertions. Here is verse 7, in which Nagarjuna frames his response. He says, "You really do not understand emptiness and the reasons for teaching emptiness. You do not understand the meaning of emptiness, and so are troubled by it." So this kind of sounds a little condescending, I thought. So I'm not going to present the whole chapter, but just 3 more verses. And why do I pick these 3? It's because, according to Thich Nhat Hanh, these 3 verses are the most famous in the entire text, the most studied. And I present them now as part of Nagarjuna's elucidation of emptiness and its importance. So here is verse 10. Without relying on conventional truth, you cannot realize ultimate truth. Without realizing ultimate truth, you will not attain nirvana. So this verse is about the teachings of what we call the two truths, conventional or relative truth, and an ultimate or absolute truth. And it points to their interdependence. You know, we say the absolute and relative inter are, they're not separate. We separate them for just purposes of teaching and discussion, but they inter are. They're about the interbeing of what we call the absolute and relative. So I understand this verse to mean that if we fully recognize, penetrate into the nature of the relative, we arrive at the absolute. And in arriving at the absolute, we see our own true nature and thereby arrive at nirvana. This verse and Thich Nhat Hanh's commentary on it helps me to understand something Zen master Zhang Ji once said to me. She said, the absolute is only made manifest in the relative. And when she said that, it just really bent my mind. But it makes more sense to me now, you know, that these things inter-are. They are part of each other. They are part of the whole. It also reminds me of this verse. It reminds me of Frank Sinatra's Love and Marriage song. Remember that one? Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. Well, I rewrote the words a little bit. So here it is. Relative and absolute, relative and absolute. You can know them if you keep your mind resolute. This I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Here's the second famous verse from chapter 24, verse 14. Because emptiness is possible, everything is possible. If emptiness were not possible, nothing would be possible. So in the first verse, you know, the opponent is saying, you know, if emptiness is true, then the Buddha's teachings cannot be true. And Nagarjuna is saying, because emptiness is true, because emptiness is possible, everything is possible. And if it weren't possible, nothing would be possible. The meaning here is that if all conventional things had intrinsic, unchanging nature, all would be static. Nothing new would ever appear, and nothing would change and disappear. We could not grow and change. Bill Murray and Groundhog Day would live the same frustrating and unfulfilling day over and over with no resolution. It's because of emptiness, the absence of permanent self-nature, and the continual unfolding of phenomena that we can live our lives, grow and become more wise, and realize the Buddha's promise of the ending of suffering. So finally, here's the third famous verse, verse 18. This verse is said to be foundational in Tiantai Buddhism, a school of Buddhism that remains extant today. Nagarjuna writes, I call empty things that arise from conditions. They are conventional designations, and they are the middle way. So this is a restatement of and summary of emptiness. All things manifest conditionally, and although we might give them conventional names, they are neither existent in a permanent sense nor non-existent in the sense of nothingness. They are instead the middle way in between those two extremes. They are change. They transcend all notions of pairs and of opposites. They are neither the same nor different. And this, Thich Nhat Hanh says, and the realization of this is the nature of nirvana. I was talking with Zhangguang Sansa a few weeks ago, and he told me that you know, when we give a talk, it's important that the people listening to the talk know what it has to do with them. So I thought I would try to take that on. So we've heard plenty of times The fruit of Buddhist practice is not attained through words alone or through thinking and ideas. But I would say we shouldn't, however, reject words and ideas as useless. They might touch us in just the right way to open our minds, if only just a little bit wider. Or they might at least point us in the right direction or alert us to some misdirection. It's said that we all have the seed of awakening in us. Because the teaching of emptiness passed down to us by Buddha and Nagarjuna and all the wise ancestors, we know that that seed, if planted in the soil of meditation, practiced and watered with mindful inquiry, can sprout and grow and bear fruit and feed all beings. So thank you for listening today, and thank you for your hard training in the room.